Hello, hello. Welcome to Inspiring African Travel. This is James here. And thank you so much for tuning in to episode 4 of our latest series, Untamed Roots. Today, we are going to be exploring Lake Natron, the volcanic landscapes, the adventure, and culture capital of East Africa. In this episode of Untamed Roots, we're going to take you to this area that I've been lucky enough to visit twice, an accessible but very remote and breathtaking location in Tanzania. What I love about this area is that it's far from the typical safari circuit, and it offers what can only be described as surreal landscapes, but also a cultural experience that make it a real hidden gem for adventurous travelers. We're going to be sharing insights into this unique setting with the iconic Old Donyo Lengai volcano that is the incredible backdrop to this destination, and the remarkable experiences that we had on that mountain and with the local Maasai people in the Lake Natron area. During this episode, we're going to be covering the overnight trek of what is considered East Africa's hardest climb, climbing to the top of Old Donyo Lengai, and the beauty that this incredible volcano offers you when you get up there. We'll also be talking about other hikes and walks in the area, including the Ngaro Sero Gorge, and how much you can enjoy cooling off in those amazing pools and waterfalls, and also a little bit about getting to know the local Maasai community and sharing some of our personal experiences and conversations that we had with the wonderful people from the Lake Natron area. And of course, like every episode, we'll be sharing some amazing tips for getting the most out of your experience and your stay in Lake Natron. We stayed at Lake Natron Camp. It's one of my favorite eco lodges in Africa, and we'll also be telling you a little bit about why it makes the perfect base for exploring that area. And so we hope you're really gonna enjoy it. I think what makes this area so special is that if you are an intrepid hiker, or even someone who just enjoys a bit of culture, or maybe you're just looking to get off the beaten path and want to immerse yourself in this awe-inspiring landscape, you don't have to always be out there doing a million things, then this episode is definitely for you, and hope it inspires you to visit Lake Natron one day. If you do need any further information, the details are in the notes. You can visit the Lake Natron camp, which has loads of information about the area and the activities that you can do there. And as always, a big thank you to my friends at Blue Baobab Safari, who've helped me many times planning and booking my trips throughout Eastern Africa. You're welcome to get in touch with them on the website bluebaobabsafari.com. Hope you guys enjoy the episode, and if you've got any questions, welcome to be in touch. Enjoy, and catch you later.
Anything else? You happy with everything else? Any other comment?
Could you move your office a little bit to the left?
Yeah, no problem. Just give me a minute. So where are you in your office?
Heating is on. It's getting wild here, bro.
Is it getting cold?
Devon storm came in last night, blew the place to pieces.
Really, yeah?
Oh, yeah. So no messing around here.
You batten down the hatches.
Yeah.
Nice.
Won't stop me going for a run this afternoon, though.
Good man. I need to run this afternoon.
Mate, you look good, though. You look like you've been for a run. Is that offensive?
I got dressed to go for a run.
Oh.
And then I dropped Aiden at school and realized that I wasn't going to drop Aiden at school, run, read the Lake Natron notes, and be ready for this in time. So I dropped the run, but I stayed in my running clothes so I can run later. brilliant.
Well, mate, thanks for agreeing to do another East Africa episode. And as we chatted about earlier, Lake Natron is probably the ideal destination to fit the brief of our current series, Untamed Roots. It's a place that Jules said that she wanted to take me, that next time we went to go to Arusha to see the family, she said, you've got to check out this Lake Natron place. And I didn't know anything about it. And we had plans to go out there. And of course, when she passed away, going on the missions to see these places, went there with the family first in September last year. And we loved it. Went with Jules's family, her mum, sister, and niece, and we had just the best time. And went back again with the God family in March after the Mount Meru hike. Hashtag episode 2. And yeah, I was a bit worried that they would, like, if they would love that place, because it is, it's a harsh place. It's a long time to get there, and I, you know, it's not everybody's cup of tea potentially. So, but they were absolutely captivated by it. So from what you've seen of the place, mate, online and all my chats, what do you think?
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, I'm looking forward to hearing about the experience. I did start looking at it on the map and everything, and it really does look out there, if that makes sense, like a bit of an adventure to get there. But it looks amazing and complete, very unique. So I'm looking forward to hearing about kind of how, what the attraction is, why anyone would want to go there, and kind of what your thoughts are about, show people that it's worth experiencing. Again, you know, there's a lot of attractions in East Africa. Just give us a little bit of a rundown before you get into the logistics of your trip. Like just a, what is Lake Natron? If someone, if you're telling someone for the first time, they don't, they have no idea about it. You know, give us a brief of what it really is all about.
57 kilometers long. 22 kilometers wide, 1,000 square kilometers, roughly the size of Belgium. Just kidding, just kidding.
I was about to say it's not the size of Belgium.
Just a classic in-joke for those of you who are dedicated listeners.
Okay, so it's a long, it's quite long in length, and 22 kilometers wide, right?
What's unique about it is it's a highly alkaline lake. These volcanic streams that come out from the ground near the lake and feed into it, because you've got this active volcano behind it. And obviously with a high level of evaporation, it's very intense. And so the lake is famous for the lesser flamingo colonies that have got out there. So you've got this, so talking beyond the lake, you've obviously got the lake itself, but around it, you've got the start of the Great Rift Valley and this epic volcano in the background, and then millions of flamingos. And also with the alkaline nature of the lake, you've got these epic colors that come out in various parts of the lake, these dark blacks, the whites from the salt, the pink from the flamingos, and the various dark and light reddish colors that come off the lake. It is otherworldly. There's only way to describe it, mate. It is just like another planet. And, you know, you hear that thrown around about various places, but that's essentially like what it feels like when you go in there. As you enter the southern side of the lake from the Tanzania side, from the village in Ngarasero, you go up, and basically, yeah, that's where you see, you're surrounded by this amphitheater of mountains. You've got the volcano behind you and flamingos everywhere.
Amazing. Unbelievable. So the volcano is right near the lake. You see it kind of in close proximity with the lake kind of surrounded by the mountains. Is that right?
It looks like a volcano that you would draw when you're a kid in kindergarten.
That's a good description, actually.
Just literally. With a little at the with top.
On the top. And Jim, the flamingos, they, I mean, obviously to see that many flamingos is a sight to behold. Are they always there? Do you think, do they come in and out? I mean, I'm sure the numbers fluctuate.
Yeah, they're always there, the flamingos, but they obviously they come in different different volumes. The best time of the year to see the flamingos is obviously during the breeding season.
Mm-hmm.
So those they start breeding from about June to October. Prior to that, they build their little nests. So I went there in September, back end of the that was the first time I went, back end of the season. And there were, yeah, there were thousands and thousands of them. The chicks were quite big, so you've got a mixture of the lesser flamingos, greater familiar flamingos, and then juveniles as well. They're so beautiful. They're such beautiful, majestic animals. I'd love to be there also during the mating season as well, because you get far more of those displays, you know, like those classic displays you've seen to the backing of ballet music, where they all move with their heads up in a formation. We saw bits of it, but obviously if you're there around about prior to the breeding season in sort of April time, you'll get to see that. Watching them move all around the part of the lake, they're gorgeous, and seeing them fly with the Rift Valley in the background in the sunset. So one of the typical activities that you can do when you're there is go out towards sunset and walk along the mud flats to the edge of the lake slowly, so as to not to startle them. They are quite habituated and relaxed among the visitors, but you approach slowly and you get to hear them and see them pretty close. Obviously, please take binoculars, because that is a game changer. And then they just move around and you get to see them flying low along the Rift Valley with the gorgeous orange sun behind it. What a sight to behold, mate. And it's the most important breeding ground for lesser flamingos that aren't as prolific as other flamingos. So you're probably looking at about 2/3 of all of the world's lesser flamingos are breeding and born in Lake Natron. So phenomenal, phenomenal place.
That's an incredible stat. So, and then you just, I mean, you walk around the edge of the lake, right? I mean, I gathered that what you say. You drive in there, and then you're kind of free to move around and walk a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So there's two things to say about Lake Natron in terms of how it differentiates itself from the standard tourist track in that area. The first point is that it is basically shooting off in the complete opposite direction where your typical safaris go in that area. So the northern circuit of Tanzania, you've got familiar names like the Serengeti, Ngorongoro Crater, Lake Manyara, Tarangire, all those areas, which essentially you go from Arusha north in a northerly direction, and then you also head a little bit into the west, northwest, that area. Lake Natron is basically you head up on that road towards Ngorongoro Crater and you just shoot right. You head northeast in the opposite direction. And it takes about 6 hours to get there from Arusha, give or take, depending on how you go in your journey. So if you go from, like, for example, Ngorongoro Crater, it's going to take you, also 5-6 hours to get there from that area. So it's off the track. So as a result, not a lot of people go there because you can't really combine it with all the other classic bucket list places in Tanzania. Let's be honest, they're worldwide bucket list destinations, going to the crater and going to the Serengeti. And then the other thing makes it a marginal tourist area is that there isn't a prolific amount of wildlife there.
Yeah.
So you're familiar with places we've spoken about in Botswana that take guests to areas outside of the key wildlife viewing areas. And of course, that's a massive draw for people. Why they're going to these places in Tanzania is to go and see epic numbers of wildebeest, zebras, all the predators. It's just the game there in that part of Tanzania just basically is tripping over themselves to see you. Whereas when you head out to Natron, it's a safe area. You can walk around. You will see the numbers of gazelles wildebeest and zebra, and actually far more than I was led to believe. But obviously they're in small numbers and moving around with the livestock and the Maasai people. So yeah.
So it really is off the normal circuit. You say 5 to 6 hours. I mean, are you, so if someone's visiting Tanzania, and obviously they are including some of the main bucket points, I suppose two questions. The one is, do you like hire a guide and a vehicle who takes you across there? Do you guys self-drive out there? Like, what's the access like? What are the options? And then obviously, like, the big question is like, who do you think would want to add Lake Natron to their Tanzania trip?
Well, I took my godparents there, and it was their first trip to Tanzania. So don't think for one moment that it's a destination that you should be taking people who've been to Tanzania before and want to see something else. No, I disagree. I think that you can definitely combine it with other destinations that are your first time visits to the area, and take yourself away from that intense wildlife experience. Have a break. We've spoken about it so many times, haven't we?
Mm,
yeah. The type of person that should be going there should be someone who wants diversity on their experience, and getting away from the higher tourist numbers and escaping to a place of, you know, gorgeous, dramatic landscape. And we'll talk about the Maasai culture, because it's a fundamental part of the experience in Tanzania and Kenya. That Maasai tribe is a very proud people and incredibly proud of their region, and still actively engaged in their traditional cultures and things. So that area of Natron, is that Maasai culture is alive and well. It is really interesting to spend time in that area with the people, and without the distraction, if you like, of being on safari and going on all of that, and take it all in. So anybody that's keen to spend some time at one with nature without the wildlife element of your trip, and to really absorb the culture and to get to know the people a little bit better, that's the place to go. And then, of course, another perfect opportunity for anybody going to safari is, like we know, you're often going to be sitting on a vehicle moving from place to place.
Yeah.
Lake Natron is an active traveler's paradise. There is so much to do in terms of walking, hiking, bike riding, trekking, you name it. So anybody who's itching to get out the vehicle and go exploring, you are going to have a ball in the Lake Natron area. And awesome. So, yeah, and that's and basically how people get around, basically the international tourists, everyone tends to have a vehicle and a guide. Whether you're as a couple, you can generally pretty easily afford to have your own guide and your own vehicle, and you just move from place to place. So I would say I would encourage you to engage your tour operator and put Lake Natron on the map. I think the key is what makes it so alluring, and why we're featuring it on this podcast, is that a lot of people who sell and have sold northern Tanzania for many years will not even know Lake Natron. I know people from Arusha involved in tourism don't know anything about Lake Natron.
Wow, that's amazing. And I mean, I think I like your point about the, like, we forget, like, people always going to the wildlife hotspots, but you often then constricted and stuck in the vehicle, right? So adding in like a Lake Natron where you break away from that, and you're getting out, you're walking, you're being in the space, like, that's such an incredible experience. And then obviously in a place like Lake Natron, where it's so unique, like, there's nothing else like it. You know, you're getting this really cool experience where you kind of, your feet on the ground, walking and kind of taking it all in and slowing down a little bit, which is also really important on these safaris, because it can be, you know, like, it can be really busy. But the culture element is important, isn't it? I mean, you can speak a little bit more about it, but I mean, the Maasai culture and the people, it's so widely known. but only really known from a tourism perspective, right? Not really so much how people are actually living, which is, you know, it's also a little bit about our trip to Lesotho where we just walked around in that community area. It certainly sounds like that. It sounds like you get that real experience as to how the Maasai are living in that area. And if it's a harsh environment, it's incredible to see how the people adapt and are able to function and live in such a unique place.
Yeah, man. We've spoken about it so much, Stu. Mm. I mean, the interaction between travelers and the local people and their livestock is something that we initially have always felt like it's something you need to avoid when you're on a safari.
Yes.
But in actual fact, being in that part of Tanzania and staying in your camp, in your room, and having an afternoon siesta and hearing the sounds of the local herders moving their livestock down to have a drink on the river, or moving them from place to place. And these guys cover vast distances. I find it incredibly soothing, you know, to be in that environment. It just takes you back into your sort of instinctual feelings as a person of, you know, something that we were, you know, our ancestors did many, many years ago. And you're in a marginal area that's obviously supporting the local communities out there. So being in this area where fewer people go, your traveling makes a massive difference, which really resonates with our people, with our listeners. But I think what's also key is that probably most of the people that are listening to our podcast are convinced already. But I met the first person I ever met at Lake Natron was a Dutch couple, and we were sitting in the afternoon heat. And let me tell you, this place is harsh, you know. It gets brutally hot. You get sandstorms. I mean, like when you're talking about otherworldly or a place that looks like Mars, feels like it as well sometimes. And they were there in the afternoon, and they were like, there's not much to see in this place. You know, we've just been to Grimeti, and we saw so many lion kills, and it's been incredible. Like, people are so blown away by the wildlife experiences that they've had there, that they're like, well, you know, why am I here? And I was like, yeah, but look where you are, mate. I was like, is this not incredible? And they, yeah, but it's really hot. You know, so these type of people, I don't have a lot of time for them. I just move on and just go, it's their loss. I mean, I don't know why you would be in a place that is so captivating and think to yourself why you're there. But I actually did speak to them to the end of their trip. I think they were just a bit hot and bothered at the time, and they loved it in the end. And I think it allows you to just be at one with the place. But yeah, culturally, the place is rich, and spending time with the local people and walking to the village, seeing the traditional houses and how the people go about their business. I just enjoy hanging out, man. You know, just seeing people, talking to the locals. From a photography point of view, it's insane, because you've got that dramatic wild, that scenery, that wild landscape, and then the beautiful colors of the Maasai blankets and the ladies wearing their jewelry, very proud people, and very, very, very beautiful sight. And the people there are very at one with nature. You know, it's quite interesting just to talk to people. What I loved about when my godparents there is, what, on the first day we went out on an activity, Max and I went to climb the volcano. My godfather was desperate for a walk, exactly what we were talking about earlier, having been on safari for 4 days, 4 nights, 5 nights. They were ready to get in there, and he was ready to get out, and he went for a 10-kilometer walk with Dowdy, and all the guides there come from the local community, and they're very traditional Maasai men. And they took him out for a walk, and they just nattered the entire way and learned so much about life in the village and life for a Maasai person in terms of their beliefs. You know, they are very much at one with nature in the sense of, you know, the mother nature, if you like, gods, the gods around them is very much the power of nature and ancestors. So we'll always say, won't we, that you get out what you put in. And I think that if you are willing to allow time for your guide to get to know you and be open and ask questions and just be just gentle. I think, you know, a lot of travelers might just go in there all guns blazing and ask a million questions, and sometimes a guide will hold back a bit. If you allow them that time and just relax and just be open to anything, I think you could get a really enriching experience out there with one of the Maasai guides spending time in that area.
Yeah, that's so cool. And I think there's, I mean, again, there's so much value in the people element that people often forget about. You know, obviously when you're in these wildlife areas, the focus is always on the wildlife. But if you, and I like the way you say, you know, you get out what you put in. If you take the time and you go and you walk in the community and you talk to a guide like your godfather did, just kind of just hanging out, you just learn so much, right, about how other people live on the other side of the world in these remote places. Gives you, changes your perspective on you and what you do and where you live, and it's just good for the soul, right? It's just it's so important, and we see it so often when people come and travel to Africa, and you know, people always talk about the people, the warmth of the people. So that's you know, again, it's just another, it's another incredible way to experience that and to and kind of get in touch with that, right? I'm jumping around because I've got lots of questions. The mountain, the volcano. Give us a rundown. Is it big and smoky? Is it you walk around? I mean, well worth the experience,
mate. Oh, okay. Where to start? First of all, I mean, like I've told at the beginning, it is the backdrop to this destination. It's a very steep volcano, and it actually, you'd be forgiven for thinking if you looked briefly that it actually has it's a snow-capped mountain or volcano, but it's not. That is the ash from the natrocarbonatite lava. It's a very unique lava that bubbles out of this volcano. Sure. A very cool grayish lava, and it forms this sort of ashy bicarbonate soda kind of vibe on the top of the mountain. So it's called Oldonyo Lengai, which is Mountain of the Gods. So as I was saying, the Maasai, it's a place obviously that they've learned over generations to fear and to respect. And it is somewhere you can hike to the top of. Sure. They call it East Africa's hardest one-day trek. Sheesh. And let me tell you, it is. having done the highest and the second highest, I can tell you that Oldonyo Lengai is without doubt the hardest thing I've ever done in the trekking space. Those of you who want to do it, you need to have a good level of fitness. I wouldn't say you need to do a you know, a formidable amount of training. You just need to be a strong walker, and you need to be ready for a tough physical and a mental challenge.
What is the challenge? Is it because it's physically demanding? It's brutal. Is it the conditions? What do you think makes up the, or a combination of the above? Why is it so difficult?
Well, good question. So, in terms of the height of the mountain, it's just under 3,000 meters above sea level. So what's that? Just about 10,000 feet. So altitude-wise, it's not high in comparison to your Mount Merus and Kilimanjaros, which are sitting at 4,000 and, yeah, what is Kilimanjaro? 5,800 meters. So significantly higher. But it is the steepness of the climb. Yeah, you're basically climbing about 1,700 meters in elevation gain in that trek, and the whole entire ascent is about 6 or 7 kilometers, depending on exactly where you start your hike. So yeah, you put it in perspective, 6 or 7 kilometer hike and 1.7 kilometers high.
Great.
So you basically, yeah, it's, I worked it out. It was for every 10 meters you're walking, you're averaging about 3 meters climbing.
Sure.
Up. So, and some places the incline is at about, yeah, some reaches 45 to 60 degrees in elevation, or in vertical steepness. So, you know, if 90 degrees is a vertical wall, you know, you can imagine 45, 60 degrees. It's tough, mate. And there's no switchbacks as well. So there are at some points, but for vast stretches of the hike, especially at the end, there's no opportunity to do switchbacks to make the climb more steady. So you're just literally going up like this.
Straight up.
And straight up. And it's at night, you've got the advantage because obviously you set off, like most of these summits, you set off at about 11 o'clock at night or midnight, depending on the speed of your team. And you're hiking through the night to get up to the top for sunrise. You actually want to be at the top before sunrise because you have the opportunity to see the glow of the lava. So that's why you're also going. And then also you want to avoid the heat of the day because as the sun rises and you start to head down, the heat becomes intense. So yeah, you've got a number of sort of harsh factors to fight against. And then also to make it even more difficult, the trail itself is like a ashy, powdery sand. It's not much purchase on your feet. And then also at the end, and at the end when you're going up in the darkness, it's quite sketchy. If you're scared of heights, you're literally climbing up what feels like 60 degree climb of like somebody who's just poured concrete down, and it's just there's nothing really to save your fall as you're going up, so it can be very, very sketchy. So when you're going down, when the light comes up, it's even more sketchy because you start to see all the areas around you. I'll never forget a moment of getting close to the summit on the first time I was doing it, and one of the Maasai guys dropped his wooden stick, one of his herding, like shepherd stick. And because you're climbing up this sort of gully of lava, he dropped it and the stick bounced. And all you could hear was the echo of this wooden stick bouncing on this lava. And it went on for like 3 minutes. Gung, 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 gung. And you just thought to yourself, whoa, that man's never getting his stick back. And God forbid if you were to fall off the path yourself, because there's nothing going to hold you back.
But okay, now, I mean, is the view, is it spectacular as the sun rises and to see the lava and stuff? I mean, it's got to be worth it, right?
It is insane. It is one of the most beautiful moments of my life. I've got a shout out to the guide that I've done it twice with, Lebonguti, or Loy. I'll put his Instagram handle up on the notes. He's such a legend. Wacky sense of humor, very professional guide and lovely guy. And I went up with him the first time and it was just me and him, and then three other Belgian people with their own guide. And then when I went up with Max in March this year, me, Max and Lebonguti were the only people on the entire volcano. Like,
wow.
Dude, where can you get these experiences in That's this part insane. Of the world? Like, this is definitely one of the most incredible places you'll ever see. And it's you see these places in Guatemala and things where there's like loads of backpackers and people hiking these. Like, this is an incredible place on this planet. And we were the only people going up there. And when you, having done that mental challenge of getting to the top, and I won't lie, both times, both me and Lebonguti and with Max, when we had a bit of rain and cold weather to contend with, both times we went, oh, I don't know if I can do this anymore. Like, genuinely ready to turn back just because of exhaustion and fear and, just everything really. And
when you make it to the top, you have those emotions that come to the surface, and it's just, it is amazing, mate. It's a bubbling volcano with lava below it. I mean, it's the stuff you dream of as a kid. Both times conditions were tough. The clouds were basically covering the entire top of the mountain, and this cold wind and mist. And actually, we could only barely see the lava, the glow of the lava through it. But fortunately, it cleared and both times. And yeah, it was almost even more dramatic to see that curtain of fog and mist pass through and to see this crater below you.
Sure. I mean, it sounds like an adventure kind of hiker's dream, right? Because of the whole element of not a lot of people there. I mean, if you're the only person standing, you know, you three guys standing on the top of that mountain, watching that sunrise and seeing, I mean, that's just, yeah, I think people would be blown away by an experience like that. It just sounds absolutely incredible.
It really is. It's one of the best things I've ever done in my life. And also the hardest. And so I don't want to put people off, but of the challenge, I know. I think the greatest challenges are the toughest challenges, but it's worth it. Would I do it again? Absolutely.
Amazing.
A lot of people have said I was crazy to do it the second time around, having known what it was. And tips and tricks, I'll just put it out there. I mean, obviously, you set off at night. Usually most time of the year it's hot and sweaty, and there's usually a wind, so it feels warm. But make sure you pack a good amount of warm jackets and stuff, so layers to put on, because by the time you get to the top it's going to be cold and windy. And second time round with Max, I think the toughest thing for us was that we did it in March, which is after some of the rains, and so we had to contend with very tall grass, which was tough, and then we had to contend with rain. And I don't know if you remember me talking about my poncho and talking it up when I was on Mount Meru, how handy it was, throwing it over my bag and using it. So I was very, very excited to use my poncho when the rain hit. But because of the incline on Aldonio Lengai, the bloody poncho kept on tripping myself over it, because it was hanging over my feet, because obviously you can imagine the poncho and then you're climbing up like this, you're constantly standing on it. And so it's the only form of waterproofing I had, because I decided my poncho was so cool. And yeah, Max kept on hearing me going, "Fuck, fuck." It was such a pain in the ass. We got wet and cold as well. And at the top, we were able to chuck off the, it stopped raining a little bit, and we just said, right, let's bin this waterproofing. And we put on warm jackets and a change of clothing. And that was a lifesaver, because I don't think we could have enjoyed the moment of being on the top of that mountain with the cold wind in wet clothing. It would have just made it pretty unbearable. So yeah, make sure you got a good amount of kit. Don't use a poncho, take a good rain jacket, and yeah, just be prepared to be in the elements.
Sounds amazing, man.
The other awesome thing is to do the Ngaro Cerro Gorge Walk, which is a decent trek, but anybody can do it. And you hike through the gorge near the volcano, through this volcanic river, and hike up through waterfalls and into these rock pools. It is such an amazing trek, really enjoyable. Only takes 2 or 3 hours to do it, maximum. It is so much fun. For a good proportion of the actual hike, you're walking through the river, and it's this volcanic, mineral-rich water. So it feels soft and soapy on your skin. It's absolutely amazing.
True.
And I describe it as it's like a giant oasis. You imagine, you know, when those oases you see in deserts where they've got those date palms and water and like that sort of relief from the desert. That's what it feels like going into this gorge, because you've got this harsh, dry environment around you. And you step into this gorge and you see these palms and these waterfalls, and it's just incredible. So I highly, highly recommend doing that as a trek.
And what about the accommodation and stuff? What are the options? I mean, you can obviously stay right there, I assume.
Honestly, the best place to stay in that area is Lake Natron Camp. The reason being is its location. It's got a very unique location almost at the mouth of the Lake Natron, and it's highly exposed, mate. It is
so cool.
What I love about this camp is the owners. They haven't got a lawn or grass. They haven't planted trees. Everything about that camp, the way they've built it, is to keep it at one with the landscape. So it's very exposed. Like, there's a couple of other camps there that have got, you know, swimming pools and trees and stuff. At this camp, they've got these stretch tents over the, like, shade netting over the tent itself in a dark color to be at one with that sort of dark blackish lava rock.
Yeah.
And all the lighting in the camp at night is down facing lighting. It's very, very subtle. So it's very dark at night, because you don't want to disrupt the flamingo migrations at night when they fly from Lake Natron to Lake Iyasi. You're basically surrounded by the mountains all around you. So one of the tents will have a view of the volcano. The other one's got a view of the lake. The other one's got a view of the Great Rift Valley. It is an absolutely stunning camp.
Yeah, that sounds incredible, man. I mean, I like the idea that that it's built. Like, it's a harsh environment and you accept that, and then that's part of the experience, right? In the camp, you know, I mean, you can always, like you say, you can lose yourself in trying to make it as so comfortable for everyone in like this perfect place. But like, it sounds like such a cool place.
It is, mate. And you know what, another coolest part about it is they don't have a swimming pool, but they have a mineral rich one of the streams that comes from the spring near the camp. So you drive through a spring to get into the entrance of the camp, where the spring bubbles up and feeds into the lake. And they've dammed up a very small portion of that volcanic stream and created a natural swimming pool that you can just sit in during the afternoon. And these little fish come and nibble your feet and you just sit. How cool is that?
That is incredible. I mean, that's better than a pool, right?
It's so much better than a pool, mate. Yeah, I just love it. Just that element itself just shows you how much, how natural they've created this camp. They've got these new suites. You're spending about $380 per person per night to stay at this camp. So it's definitely the most high end from a price perspective. But and then you've got these new tents. They've got these suites, which are just over 400 per person, which are a little bit more airy and a bit cooler and beautiful. But yeah, I love both tents are great. And it's hot, but you just lie on this in the afternoon with the fan going, have a little cool shower, have a dip in the river. And at night, dude, like, I heard the sound of flamingos and I came out. And I just remember sitting up looking at the stars, and you couldn't really see them, but all you could hear was about 5,000 lesser flamingos flying at night, migrating from one lake to the next, and the sound of a thunderstorm. We basically had a sandstorm, thunderstorm pushing in from the Kenyan side. Sheesh. It's just a wild, wild place. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, what a special place, eh? I love the thought that it's just like so out there. I mean, everyone often talks about the busyness of some of these East African safaris. And like there's clearly so many gems and stuff out there that are completely unique. And this is just, I think, just fits that mold so well, you know, for an adventurous traveler. Like you say, the kind of people that listen to this podcast are looking for stuff that's different. It just sounds absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, for sure. And we haven't touched on some of the other things. I mean, if those are interested in anthropology or any visitor, they've discovered about 10 years ago these ancient human footprints that have been preserved in a mixture of mud and basically lava and dust, volcanic dust. And they're permanent footprints that are dating back maybe 5,000, 20,000 years. So some of the oldest modern man footprints in that area. And they just, yeah, there's like hundreds and hundreds of these footprints. So there's a lot of studies going on there. So that's really interesting.
Wow.
And yeah, like I said earlier, you can do anything you want. Like we were active. We did the climb on the first night. We did the trek up the gorge on the second day. And then on the third day, on the morning of departure, we went for a run with Lebonkuti. This was so cool, mate. First thing in the morning, we met our guide. Lebonkuti came with his, he came with his beatbox. yeah, he just squashed his beatbox in the back of his shorts. And we went for a run listening to these banging tunes. And yeah, it was so cool. Although I learned a harsh lesson. I don't know, when we start doing our training together, mate, my trademark move is a little last minute sprint at the end. But
oh, really?
I try and win it every time. And I made the mistake of trying to out sprint a Maasai.
Come on, man.
It was so funny, dude. I misjudged it completely. And so I was like, I got myself ready. I lowered the pace in anticipation. And then I tried to distract him and Max. And I was pointing them around to the volcano and asking them a question. And then I sped off into the distance, trying to leave them in the dust. I misjudged it completely because I realized it was far too long before we got to the end of our run. And this guy, if I looked around my court, he looked like a freaking gazelle. Lebonkuti, like he, you know, Wilson Kipcheng, the fastest runner, he looks like him as well. And I remember watching him run like this. He had this look, his steely look. He's like, how dare you on my patch try and take me down, right? And he was running like he was on clouds, and he just glided and he went past me, and he didn't even look me in the eye. He just ran past and just jumped over the little bits of puddles and springs and left me there.
Oh, that is fantastic.
So I got schooled.
Listen, Ray, I can't imagine it can be easy to outrun a Maasai guy who runs in that kind of environment all the time.
Exactly. He grew up walking 50, 60 kilometers, moving between his livestock every day. So now we had so much fun and really got to know the guides and the staff there that live in that camp and live in that area. We're also going to work closely with the school there and hopefully support one of the students that is going to be graduating from that school there. My godparents love it so much. My family have loved it. It's just a place that rewards you. It's all about the people, right? But it's amazing, the environment and the harshness of the environment, yeah. I love so much. So yeah, we've hired motorbikes out there. You can hire mountain bikes. It's just a haven of adventure and exploration. And yeah, I just can't wait to go back.
So Jim, just a quick one, just before we wrap it all up. I mean, like, so someone is going out there, how long do you spend there? What do you reckon? I mean, I know it's how long is a piece of string, but it's you really want to give yourself the time to get into the experiences. And it seems like there's actually quite a lot to do there for kind of active traveler, right?
I mean, minimum 3 nights, I would say. If you're going to go for 2 nights, you're not allowing yourself enough time to do any of the proper activities. So, for example, if you wanted to go there for 2 nights and then try and do the hike up to the top of Aldonio Lengai, then you're basically writing off most of your trip because, yeah, you're going to be climbing it on that first night and getting back at midday, and then you're going to pass out. So that's just your day gone. So yeah, 3 days is pretty much a must for me. And if you go onto the website, Lake Natron Camp, we'll put it in the notes. They also do, and we've touched on this before, and I think this is the next trip when we go out there, is to do one of the trekking adventures that they do. And they use Lake Natron as a base for that. You can do 4 or 5 day treks through the Great Rift Valley up towards Ngorongoro Crater, through Maasai villages that barely see any visitors or any tourists at all.
Wow.
They set up little camps for you. Footprints of Mankind and amazing treks that they do through the company based at Lake Natron Camp. That's a game changer. So you can actually do those treks as well and use Lake Natron as a base for that as well. But I think that would be something that we should set up to do next year or maybe the year after, whenever we can find time in all of our wish lists of adventures to do together, Stooge.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, man, I got to get up there, man. We really got to make a plan. There's so much to see and do and experience. It just sounds incredible. Yeah, thanks, man. I really enjoyed that. I mean, I think you obviously we're going to put the links and stuff in the notes so people can check it out. And I'm sure you've got loads of pictures and stuff to show. So we'll put that all up there so people can get a really good experience to how unique that environment really is.
Absolutely. That it is. Thanks, brother.
Shot, man. Yeah, that was great. Thanks for the catch up.
Can't wait to head out there with you. Have a good one. Good luck today.